again, and welcome to The Tome, Episode 3, Hordes of the Abyss. The Tome is a D&D game book review podcast focused on official D&D content. If you would like to contact the show, you can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the site at http://thetome.podbean.com and leave a comment, or you can visit the new forum at http://thetome.freepowerboards.com. Also, if you like the show, you can vote for it at Podcast Pickle or leave a review on iTunes and let others know about it. In this episode, I'm going to review Fiendish Codex 1, Hordes of the Abyss. Coming up in future shows, I will review Complete Mage, Expedition to Castle Ravenloft, and Dragon, Issue 350. If you would like to submit a guest review for any of these, please email thetomeshow@gmail.com or leave a comment on the forum at http://thetome.freepowerboards.com. Now, on to the review for Fiendish Codex 1, Hordes of the Abyss. Chapter 1, Demonic Lore. The book starts off introducing you to this idea of the Black Scrolls of Om, which is this extremely complete sort of collection of pages that is artifact-like in its function and in its ability to impart knowledge about demons and other denizens of the lower planes, especially the Abyss. More than it being a neat little item, it actually serves as sort of a story framework that provides sort of the fluff to connect all of the crunch that's in this book. It's an unneeded attempt to create cohesiveness to the rest of the book, but you don't honestly see a lot of it. It doesn't take up a lot of space, so I guess if a listener wants to have that sort of fluff to connect their crunch, then it does a fine job of that. It then goes on and gives some cursory information about demons. The sort of thing that you would see in a typical article in Dragon Magazine that features a creature. It sort of talks about the physiology of demons. It talks about a theory behind the origins of demons and where they came from. And it also discusses the various means that a demon might get to the material plane where they're more likely to interact with your players and your player characters. All in all, no big surprises in this section. It then talks a little bit about demonic roles, which as a DM is sort of a neat little idea to I guess, help make it a little easier to run a demon in a combat and do it intelligently and in a way that fits well what you want to do with the demon. It gives you sort of round-by-round tactics for different demons based on not the type of demon they are, but what role they're playing in your game. It also gives a little bit of an idea for players on how to fight against a demon that's playing that role. The different roles, to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, the different roles are assassin, brute, corruptor, manipulator, and overlord. So you can fit most demons into these general roles, and then it gives you an idea of how to play them in a combat situation, or if you're a player, how to fight against a demon playing that role. It finishes off this section with a little more crunch. It's a little bit more of that rules, a little bit that you can really integrate into your game here. And that is talking about the idea of possession, demon possession. And honestly, I thought this was great. Finally, I see some good rules about what happens when a demon possesses either people or items. How it's done, what effects it has, and it even brings back sort of the idea of roles again, by discussing what kind of role your demon possessor might play in your game. What is it that they're doing as a possessing demon? Are they sort of driving people insane? Are they trying to manipulate them? Are they trying to take control of the body or the item or whatever? And so that comes up again with the idea of roles. Well, this chapter tries to sort of throw a bone to players by talking about how players can fight against the different roles, really this is a chapter for the DMs. If you're running a game with demons, read this first. This is going to give you some good ideas about how to run demons well in your game. In fact, the idea that this chapter is just for is mostly for DMs but tries to throw a bone to players seems to be a running theme throughout the whole book. The whole book seems to be really neat for DMs, and it just sort of throws out an occasional bone to players. It's really a book, to let a DM play really neat demons and how to integrate them into their game and how to integrate the Abyss into their game. Chapter 2, Demons. This is the monster section of the book, New Creatures. It starts off by discussing three demonic subtypes, the well-known Tenari, which are the current rulers of the Abyss. Then it talks about the Laumara, which is an emergent set of demons, and they're demons that they say are created from the dreams of dead gods. And then there's the Oberith, which are the former ancient rulers of the Abyss before the Tenari came along, and they've sort of been in decline ever since the rise of the current rulers of the Tenari, although there's a few of them still sort of hiding out and hanging out in the Abyss, as you'll see as we continue. Some standout creatures, because I don't want to take the time to discuss every single new creature they give us, so I'll discuss just a few brief standouts that I thought were particularly interesting. First of all, let me say that if I mispronounce anything, I guess I'm not that fluent in Abyssal, and you'll have to forgive that, but I'm going to do my best. We start off with the Barlagura, which is basically, it looks like a dire ape, which I'm not sure I really like in my demons, that it just looks like a big, nasty ape thing. It does have demonic powers. It has it's more intelligent than your typical ape. It's definitely a threat to be reckoned with. But it's not necessarily something that's as unique as what I usually look for in a demon. So there's that. Then is the Brood Swarm, which is a swarm of tiny demons tied to night hags, which stitch up their victims in this sort of black thread that they create. There's the Debuk, which is one of your Lemora. This is a disembodied creature of death that possesses the bodies of the fallen and can cause instant death with a touch. There's the Echolid, which is an Oberith, which is sort of an insectoid monstrosity. And this is said to be the manifestation of fear of infestation, because as it stings its victim, it implants eggs into the host, which can then, of course, infest and spreads that fear. There's the Maladeus, which is your Tenari. It's a wolf-headed Tenari with a snake that comes out of the back of its neck. This is sort of your police force of the Abyss, if you can have a police force in a chaotic evil plane. They are sort of the enforcers, I guess. And they're comparable in power to the often thought of as mighty Balers. Then there's the Sybarex, which is a floating, bloated, fleshy sort of mass of an Oberith. These guys are masters of grafting flesh onto flesh. So if you want to get yourself a fiendish graft, then this is the guy. This is the demon you want to make a deal with, and they'll hook you up, so to speak. Chapter 3, Demon Lords. Okay, so it starts off by briefly mentioning the idea of aspects of demon lords, which are sort of weaker versions that act as proxies on the material plane for demon lords, so they don't have to take the risk of actually going to the material plane where they're not as formidable. But it doesn't really give you anything about them. Instead, it says that there's samples available of aspects on the web enhancement. Go download that. Which sort of begs the question of why bother mentioning it if it's an enhancement, then it shouldn't need to be mentioned. If it's an integral part of the concept in the book, then it needs to be in the book. Or at least they could, if they knew this was going to be there and they had this material available at the time that they printed the book, they could have at least put it on a CD and stuck it in the cover of the book or something, and it wouldn't even cost them that much more money compared to adding several more pages to the book, which would be fairly expensive for him. But anyway, second, it mentions that the stats for the Demon Lords in this book barely crack the CR20. Okay? They're not really the incredibly epic sort of Demon Lords that you may be used to. This is really one of the only parts of the book that I'm not very fond of. This is the one part of the book that I don't like the fact that they sort of neutered a lot of the Demon Lords and made them a lot weaker than I thought they should be. The idea that a standard, although old, dragon could beat on the nearly, or supposed to be nearly godlike power of a Demon Lord sort of bothers me. I mean, some of these Demon Lords would be hard-pressed in a fight with a well-prepared Pit Fiend or a Baelor, who are supposedly minions by comparison. Now I want to go through the various Demon Lords that they specifically highlight in the book. Just give a brief idea of who they are and what they're about. Not a lot. Again, I'll try to pronounce as best as I can, but no promises. They start off talking about Baphomet, Prince of Beasts, who's the patron of Minotaurs and has some savage sort of humanoid cult. Then Dagon, Prince of the Depths, an ancient watery demon so old it's alien-like, which I actually spoke about in my review of Dragon Magazine issue 349, because they had an article detailing Dagon in even more depth. Demogorgon, Prince of Demons, the two-headed, although contested, most powerful demon of all demons. The prince of all demons, the guy who's sort of running the whole show, if you can say that anybody's running the whole show of demon kind, which isn't likely since they're incredibly chaotic. Fras-Urblew, Prince of Deception, patron of tricksters and illusionists, described as a hulking menace, which I never really got. I guess I don't understand why a hulking menace of a creature would be the patron of tricksters and illusionists. Although I like the Demon Lord, I like the guy, I like the character, I like the use of him. His power set matches being the patron of tricksters and illusionists. I just never really got the connection between the appearance of the creature and his role. Just never really matched up for me, but sometimes I guess that sort of grows on me too, the idea that he's the patron of tricksters and illusionists, and yet he doesn't look the way you would think he would look. So I guess it works. Then there's Graz, the Dark Prince, who is a corrupter, seducer, and keeper of secrets. Druiblex, the Faceless Lord, patron of oozes and shapeless things. Costochinchi, Prince of Wrath, and that one I really can't pronounce, who is sort of a deformed patron of frost giants. Malkanthet, Queen of Succubi, who ruins people with her beauty and charm. Obex Ob, Prince of Vermin, who is a hidden Oberyth, Lord of Vermin and Poison. Orcus, Prince of Undead, who's come back from death, giving him power over undead. Pale Night, the Mother of Demons, an Oberyth said to be the mother of the most powerful demons in existence today. Pazuzu, Prince of the Lower Aerial Kingdoms, Lord of Evil Flying Creatures. Yunogu, Prince of Gnolls, and for some reason, Ghouls. And Zugtmoy, Lady of Fungi, the fungal creator of the Temple of Elemental Evil, if you're familiar with that. Chapter 5, Trafficking with Demons. This is the place where the writer sort of said, hey, we should throw something in for PCs. So this is the PC sort of chapter. It starts off by identifying roles for PCs in a game that has lots of demons in it. You've got the demon hunter, the master, the summoner, the worshiper, all the different things that a mortal might do with dealing with demons in a game. It then goes through prestige classes from other books that are tied to demons, sort of just letting you know that, hey, there's other prestige classes out there that deal with demons and would fit really well. It only takes up a quarter of a page. It's not very big. And it gives info that should be generally obvious if you own or have read that prestige class in the other books anyway. Of course, if you haven't read it, or if you don't own it, I guess it's pretty useless information for you anyway. I'm not really sure that this section has much value, although since it's so tiny, I guess it's not a big loss either. A good chunk of this chapter, though, has all kinds of new feats. It has lots of new vile feats that you might have been introduced to with the Book of Vile Darkness. But what the real highlight is the Abyssal Herodor feats. For those people who have sort of demonic blood burning through their veins, these feats will grant you various abilities allowing you to tap into the primal evil powers that are part of your blood kin and that sort of thing. So you can get lots of neat little abilities, or if you're a DM, you can get lots of neat little abilities for NPCs or villains or what have you. Then there's a handful of new spells that they give you and new domains. I'll run through just a few brief highlights of the new spells, just to give you an idea of some of the things that are out there. There's one called Beckoning Call for bards, or the Temptation Domain, second level. It forces the subject, if they fail a save, it forces the subject to come to you. Embrace the Dark Chaos, which is a cleric, sorcerer, and wizard spell of 8th level, which switches any feat that you have for an Abyssal Herodor feat permanently. So you cast the spell, and it's a way to modify your feats, which is why it's so high level. But it's a permanent thing to sort of taint the body with that abyssal power. Morality Undone, which is a bard or cleric spell of 5th level, or from the Corruption Domain of 4th level. And this turns your target evil for 10 minutes per level. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're instantly going to turn around and start attacking their friends, right? But they are evil now, so maybe they'll be a little more haphazard and not be so, you know, you cast this on the wizard and maybe they won't be so slow to go ahead and toss a fireball that's going to fry everybody in the room, including their friends. And it has a decently long duration of 10 minutes per level, so if you're high enough level, it could have long-ranging effects. Maybe sneak up, cast it on somebody who wanders off from the party, get them hooked with this, then run away and watch the chaos ensue. And then you've got Slime Wave, the last one I'll highlight here. And Slime Wave is a cleric, druid, or ooze domain spell of 7th level, which creates a wave of green slime that spreads out, clinging to all the creatures hit by it for one round per level. And so then you have to deal with all this green slime stuff going on. Lastly, this chapter discusses a group or an organization called the Black Cult of Om, which goes back to that sort of the Black Scrolls of Om, this overriding theme that sort of ties in a lot of the ideas here of the book. It talks about the advantages of being part of the group and the goals and the motivations of this group, the cult, Black Cult of Om, and also talks about the artifact that they're tied to, the Black Scrolls. And so there's lots of information and details about the scrolls and ways that you can use the scrolls in a game and all that kind of stuff. All in all, the scrolls don't turn out to be referenced very often in this book at all. It sort of mentions them briefly at the beginning for some reason and then really goes in depth through them with these several pages to the point that I'm not sure they even needed to mention them originally to begin with, although having the information about this cult and the artifacts at this point is actually kind of neat. Chapter 5, Into the Abyss. This is the part of the book that discusses the information you need to know in order to take your campaign into the abyss. First, you get some history, including some major events from Greyhawk and the Blood War. Then it briefly describes the various inhabitants, the Tenari, the Oberyths, the Laumaras, mortals, including some of the old Planescape factions, petitioners, who are the dead souls who have ended up in the abyss, and of course, deities. Next, it talks about travel in the abyss. How do you get around on the abyss? How do you get to the abyss? How do you get other places from the abyss? All that sort of stuff. It talks about a few major ways to do that. You've got the Abyssian Ocean, which is an ocean without a bottom that touches all oceans on all layers of the abyss. So that's one way to get around, is through this massive trackless ocean. There's the Grand Abyss, which is a massive fissure created by Oberyths, tunneling. They decided in ancient times to, by brute strength, force their way from one layer to another layer of the abyss, and so they started digging this massive tunnel Oh, this massive fissure into the ground, and that's the grand abyss that goes from one layer to another layer to another layer. There's the infinite staircase, which touches all worlds and all planes that have creativity. In this case, it shows up near the sort of the wily demon lords and where they're hanging out, such as Grazd, Fras Urblu, and Malkanthet. So you might run into a doorway that opens up into the infinite staircase in the in these demon lords' realms. There's the pits of Pazunia, which is an abyssal layer with pits that sort of lead off to all the other layers. There's the River Styx, a river that runs through all of the lower planes. There's the Ships of Chaos, these massive magical ships created by demons. It seems that they created them to carry armies from one place to another, because they talk about how they can hold a massive amount of people, and they travel through the planes. It's currently thought that there are six of them, although there are shipyards out there making more. And then it talks about how there's also stable gates. Of course, you can run into the abyss and out of the abyss and to other places, or from one part of the abyss to another part using all these gates, which are pretty standard fodder in any game that includes instantaneous transport. Then it details some of the unique terrain features you might see: special storms, clouds, fogs, gates, and trees that you might run into on the abyss. And then lastly, they detail some of the infinite layers of the abyss. There's an infinite layers, but they highlight 15 of them for us. And they focus mostly on ones that have demon lords on them, or that have something important going on that has been discussed in other parts of the book. Each description of a layer includes a description of it, maps of that layer, or maps of part of that layer, since most of them are infinite, key locations, key people, and adventure hooks for each layer. I'm going to summarize briefly each of the layers, but not go much in depth, just to save some time so this doesn't go too long. The first layer is Pazunia, which is ruled by Pazuzu, although it is a contested realm of Pazuzu. Layers 45, 46, and 47 all make up one realm of Azagrat, which is ruled by Grazd. It's one of the few finite realms. It has a specific area that it takes up, and then you run into an end of that realm. There's the Demon Web, layer 66, ruled by Loth. There's no gravity, and it's an infinite realm. So there's your spider place there. There's Thanatos, layer 113, ruled by Orcus. It's a minor negative dominant plane, which gives an advantage to all his massive hordes of undead, and it's also a finite realm. You've got the Grand Abyss, which is called layer number four. It is a contested realm. It is infinite. And the idea of the Grand Abyss, of course, we mentioned earlier, is that it actually bumps into most or many of the other layers of the abyss. So it's technically the fourth layer, but it hits a lot of the other layers too. There's layer 12, which is called 12 Trees. It has no ruler. It's self-contained. It's strongly chaos and evil aligned. And it's just this small little realm with 12 trees around it that have this sort of magical power. And it's also the location, that it's a location where you can perform certain rites or rituals in order and gain certain blessings and powers from being there, because it's sort of a centralized location in the multiverse of evil and chaos. It also happens to be the location where they have the shipyards where they're building these massive ships of chaos. There's the Iron Wastes, layer number 23. The ruler is Kostichichi. It's an infinite realm. It's a cold sort of savage mountainous realm, which matches well this demon lord of frost giants. There's the Wells of Darkness, layer 73. They are unclaimed. It's finite, and it's strongly evil aligned. This is a layer that includes these large pits, or these large dark black wells that hold all kinds of evil exiled creatures. They get trapped in there. They can't get out. There's a spot where you can sort of look out and see all the different ones. They go through and they list all the different creatures that are trapped in these. There's nine pits there now holding various creatures, and it talks about all of them and how a group of characters might show up here in order to try to get information out of these ancient trapped entities. There's the Gaping Maw, layer 88, which is the realm of Demogorgon. It's another finite realm. It's largely oceanic and water-based. There's Hollow's Heart, layer number 176, ruled by Fraz Erblu, also a finite realm. There's Shedaklam, layer number 222, which is a contested realm. It's a fight between Drublex and Zugtmoy, the ooze and basically the patron of oozes fighting against the patron of fungi, trying to see who can dominate this realm. It does have a minor positive dominant role, probably because it's a realm that includes a lot of plant, well, fungal life anyway. There's a Yunogu's realm, layer number 422. It's a finite realm. Of course, it's the home of Yunogu. Has lots of gnolls, fiendish gnolls, has lots of ghouls on it. Those are the strengths and forces that tend to fill the ranks of Yunogu. There's Andralin, layer number 471, ruled by Pale Knight. And it is also a finite realm. This is sort of an interesting realm because this is a realm that has this constant war going on between Fae. So if you're interested in dealing with Fae at all, there's a lot of stuff going on with the Fae here. Basically, during the war way back, during a war way, way, way back when the Tenari first came into power, a group of good-aligned Fae got trapped on this layer of the Abyss during that war. And they're still there, and they've been there for all this time, and they've been fighting this constant war against other Fae and against demonic forces in this constant, never-ending battle. There's Shendilavari, which is layer number 570. This is Malkanthet's realm, another finite realm filled with succubi. There's the Endless Maze, layer 600, which is Baphomet's realm, which is an infinite realm of never-ending mazes. The book finishes off then with a little appendix, mostly full of lists of known demon lords, lists of known layers of the Abyss, and then lists of demons from other books that Wizards of the Coast has put out that you can look at to get more demons into your game. All in all, if you're a fan of outsiders, especially evil outsiders in a game, this is a great, great book. It's mostly useful for DMs. They do throw in a couple bones for players. As I mentioned before, every now and then they give you a little something for the players, but honestly, if you're a player, you probably don't need to have this book. If you're a DM and you want to integrate demons, this is an awesome book for you. And even make a few of those other things for players available out of your book and lend them the information they need so they don't have to go out and buy a book that only has anything for them in one chapter. I would say, however, this book is well worth the cover price and more, especially if you go above what's just in the book and check out the many web enhancements that have been released for this. So that is Hordes of the Abyss. Once again, thanks for listening. I can see from the growing numbers that there are listeners out there, and I would love to hear from you. Tell me what is good with the show. Tell me what's bad with the show. An issue was brought up by somebody earlier of, should I be doing an enhanced podcast like I'm doing, the M4A format, which not everybody might be able to listen to as easily, or should I just convert it always to an MP3 so that it's easier for everyone to listen to? Is the enhanced format worth the hassle of cutting some people out? Let me know what you think. Or if you have any other suggestions or other ideas, let me know. If you want to suggest a book review for me to do, let me know that. Or if you want to send in a quick review yourself, I'd be happy to share that. I would love for listeners to be able to get more than just my thoughts on the things that are reviewed, or only hear my thoughts on the books I'm happening to read. There's a lot of books out there that I just simply don't have the time to read, and if you want to throw in a quick review on that, I'd be happy to share it with on the show, read it on the show, or if you want to send an audio comment, that'd be great too. Coming up, I will review Complete Mage, Dragon number 350, and Expedition to Castle Ravenloft. My goal is to do at least 2 shows a month, and possibly more as time allows. You can contact the show via email, again, at thetomeshow@gmail.com, thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can leave a comment for the show on the website at http://thetome.podbean.com, thetome.podbean.com, or you can leave a comment on the forum. I'd love to see some people getting involved in the forum there and see if that's something that people are interested in as a way of giving feedback. And again, you can find the forum at http://thetome.freepowerboards.com, THETOME dot FREEPOWERBOARDS.com. And of course, if you like the show, you can give me a vote at Podcast Pickle or leave a review on iTunes. Thanks again for listening, and this has been episode 3 of
The Tome.